Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Gents against Conagra. Mr. Schultz.
May it please the court, your honors.
Good morning.
John Schultz on behalf of Westside Salvage. I'd like to begin my argument by addressing the breach of contract claim that Conagra brought against Westside at trial and our allegation of error that Judge Reagan should not have submitted that claim to the jury for the reason that there was not a contract in place on the date of this explosion.
Why did Westside not only commence work, but work for a full week if it hadn't accepted Conagra's work order?
Westside accepted the request, as stated in the contract, to remove pellets from bin 15 using a vacuum bin whip and entry as needed. However, Westside did not agree or assent to the boilerplate terms in that contract that had not been mutually agreed to by the parties. So Kathy Rahanek, who's the contract administrator for Conagra, testified at trial that from Conagra's point of view, there was not a binding contract between the parties which would force Conagra to act, i.e. pay Westside, until both Westside and Conagra had signed the contract. Thus, almost a month after this explosion, Conagra faxed a contract to Westside that was signed by Gene Schwerz and returned and countersigned by Mr. Hennig on behalf of Conagra. And at that time, Conagra acted and fulfilled its part of the contract by paying Westside for its work. On the day that Westside began its work, there was an oral agreement that Westside would begin to remove pellets from the bin in exchange for a quoted price. And that's all there was until almost 30 days after the explosion occurred. Now, the court heard evidence of the faxed work order that Conagra sent to Westside, and Ken Langham executed that and put it in his file at Westside, but it was never returned to Conagra.
I mean, wasn't Mr. Langham's explanation of why he signed the work order a bit incredible?
Well, he was a very, I guess you would call him a very detailed person. He said he signed it and put it in his file and was going to wait for Mr. Sumner or Mr. Schwerz to authorize him to send it back. That was his testimony, Judge, and I can understand the court's position on that, is why wouldn't you, if you sign it, why wouldn't you send it back? But I think what Langham explained is he didn't have authority, nor did he know the terms that had been agreed to between Conagra and Westside. Those were negotiated solely by Ron Sumner. And so he received it, signed it, kept it in his file. So, given Kathy Rahanek's testimony that Conagra considers the contract to be binding and enforceable when there's both parties' signatures to it, we take the position and we urge Judge Reagan at the trial court level not to submit the breach of contract claim against Westside. Furthermore, as it relates to the contract claim, we urge Judge Reagan to submit the damages on that claim on the basis of diminution in fair market value versus what he decided to do, which was allow Conagra to claim the cost of repair.
You know, I have a problem with that. I truly don't understand your argument as to why the cost of repair would not be the correct measure of damages. The bin and so forth were not totally destroyed, and Conagra was able to repair them. Why isn't that the end of the story? I mean, replacing damaged or destroyed components of a larger structure is a routine aspect of repair, isn't it?
Well, to go back to your first comment, Your Honor, about was it completely demolished, I think the testimony of Dean Hornig on behalf of Conagra, who was the only witness that gave testimony on this subject, was that bin C-15 was demolished after the explosion and it was rebuilt. They replaced equipment, they put in new systems, and basically Conagra got a newer, better, improved system.
But that often happens with repairs.
But in a case where we contend in a case where there is a total loss, essentially, that you can't repair it, that it would be diminution in fair market value. And given in this situation, Hornig testified that the bin was demolished. It was a total loss. They put on a new roof, new system, enhanced systems, better and more efficient systems. We contend that ConAgra got more than the cost of repair, and they were basically unjustly enriched by allowing ConAgra to submit that damage theory to the jury. I would like to visit and spend some time arguing about the punitive damage award against Westside Salvage. In this case, and this is what Judge Reagan found when he decided our post-trial motion on this issue, he said there was evidence from which the jury could find that Mel Flitch had conscious disregard for the safety of the workers when he sent them back into the tunnel to retrieve their equipment. Or the second thing he found was that a jury could have found that Westside was liable for punitive because Flitch failed to call the fire department. And I think when you look at Flitch's testimony as a whole, he said that he had no idea that bin was about to explode. His instruction to the workers to go back in and move equipment in the tunnel was so that the firefighters wouldn't encounter a danger when they came through to respond to the call that Godfrey Freet was making at or about that time.
Well, here's my problem with that. He orders Jens to go back into the bin. There's an obvious danger, it seems to me, posed by the now smoking bin. It's now smoking. I mean, even if Mr. Flitch wanted the tools for a proper reason, a correct reason, you know, to get them out of the way of these firefighters, he still knowingly, and a jury could find, I think, possibly, you know, willfully and wantonly put Jens in harm's way.
Well, I think the assumption that underscores what you're saying, Your Honor, is that Flitch must have anticipated or known that the bin was going to explode or cause harm to either Becker or Jens or Schmidt when he sent Jens and Becker back into the tunnel.
Well, I think the fact that he ordered him to go back in the bin and move the work tools out of the way may be sufficient because the bin is now smoking, as I earlier said. It's smoking, right?
Well, the bin was smoking pretty much from when they came back from lunch that day. There was black smoke coming out of the top of the bin, but yet they still worked. They were still doing their job trying to get the pellets out of the bin and remedy the situation, and they did that for a couple of hours. Not only the West Side workers, but Godfrey Freet was there as they were trying to access the porthole. So you had ConAgra and West Side people working throughout the afternoon, even though it was smoking. That's correct.
Apparently the fire department was called at that point, if he was anticipating the fire department to come. Isn't that right?
Judge, you're exactly right. When Flitch had it requested of Godfrey Freet, a couple of times, at least, the testimony supports that ConAgra and Godfrey called the fire department first in the morning, but then in the afternoon. And then I think the evidence was there was a third time that Flitch ordered that Godfrey Freet call the fire department, and he described it as an excited voice, perhaps may have even.
Well, that's when he barged in the office or something.
Barged in the office.
Yeah, well, the only reason I'm even, just from what you brought up, is that there was one complaint because he didn't call the fire department.
Right.
Well, apparently somebody did, because that's why he was supposedly sending them down to move the equipment.
After the excited entry, as we call it, Godfrey Freet did in fact make contact with the fire department. At least that was what Flitch understood. And then Flitch instructed the workers clean out or get rid of the tools in the tunnel so they don't interfere with the firefighters' response. having no idea the bin was going to explode at that time. Keep in mind, they've been working around that bin for a week. They've been working around it.
You say they had no idea the bin might explode. What does the record show about the probability that a smoking bin will catch fire or explode within a certain period of time?
Well, that would refer to the testimony of the two experts that were called, Russ Ogle, and then the expert for ConAgra talk about that. But I think it was I think it's the collective testimony of everybody there that was on site that day that they didn't expect it to explode. They were calling the fire department.
Could you answer my question? I ask, what does the record show about the probability that something will happen? I didn't ask what people had in their heads.
Well, I think the reason the fire department was called to put out the fire is that's what the people...
No, you're not remotely addressing my question.
Could you repeat it, Your Honor, please?
What does the record show about the probability that a smoking bin will catch fire or explode within a prescribed period of time? And you can name that time, an hour, 8 hours, a week.
I don't know that there was ever exact testimony on that topic, Your Honor. That's why perhaps I'm not recalling what you're referring to. But
all right. So your answer is nothing. I'll be asking the same question of everybody else. But your answer is the record shows nothing about this.
In terms of a specific time that a bin would explode once it's smoking or on fire, I don't think there was any evidence on that.
A lot of stuff turns on this because the presumption, some people's presumption seems to be that smoke means imminent danger. And the presumption reflected in your argument is that smoke means nothing. Well, there ought to be some evidence about what smoke actually means, objectively.
Mm-hmm.
You say there's no such evidence.
In terms of the timing between when you notice smoke and when there's an explosion, I don't think there was evidence on that. I do think that...
Why did your client's employee say the fire department should be called if smoke has no significance, if it doesn't mean danger?
Smoke means there was something burning in the bin. It doesn't mean, from our perspective, that it was going to explode in the near future, or Flitch would not have sent the workers in there, and that's what he testified to. So it does mean there's danger and there's a problem.
Your client's manager believes that it shows there was a high enough risk to call the fire department.
Yes.
But not a high enough risk to take precautions with respect to the company's personnel. That's a very strange position.
Well, I understand the court's point, but I think from Flitch's perspective...
You didn't know what actual risk there was.
In Flitch's mind, as he testified at trial, he did not anticipate an imminent explosion. He knew the bin was smoking, that there was some embers that had been reported, and that's why they were calling the fire department to assist. And that's why I argue that Flitch did not show a conscious disregard, because in his mindset and the people that were working around him, there was no decision to shut down the plant or to evacuate. There were still people working in and around this area. And while there was a problem in the bin, it doesn't necessarily equate to imminent explosion, is, I think, the best way I can answer your question, Your Honor. I would like to spend a moment talking about the jury question that was returned on the punitive issue with regard to ConAgra shortly before the final verdict was received by Judge Reagan. The jury did send out a question and asked if they could find one of the parties liable for punitive damages and award no damage or no monetary damage. And I think that the correct answer to that would be yes. We urged Judge Reagan to answer the question in that way. And Judge Reagan did what, frankly, most trial judges do, or almost all of them do. You send back the instruction. You must reread the instructions in the verdict form. But in this particular situation, I think it showed a clear intent from the jury not to want to award monetary punitive damages against Westside Salvage. And in answering the question the way Judge Reagan did, I think the jury concluded that they did, in fact, have to return some monetary figure, and thus the $1 million award.
Well, we would have to find abuse of discretion here.
That's
and
correct.
You're absolutely correct. Most trial judges will not give a direct answer to a jury's inquiry. And the reason for that is that it avoids the hazards of giving direct answers. And, of course, juries and the losing party will always find, you know, that frustrating. But it's absolutely the safest course to take in most instances.
And, frankly, I agree with that, Your Honor, and that's what I see done most often. But in this case, it's a little different. We advance because the jury was asking a question that if it was answered with a simple yes, yes was, in fact, the correct answer to the question, and the jury then would have returned a verdict of no monetary punitive damages because the word may is contained in the instruction that you may award if you find, you know, that West Side is liable. So we think in this specific case when a simple answer yes would have answered the jury's question and they had expressed a clear intent or idea about what they wanted to do in the question. And the one case I cite in the brief is a Seventh Circuit case. It's a criminal case, that Rios-Calderon case, where the court talks about it wasn't a direct answer to a question like I'm suggesting Judge Reagan should have given, but the judge didn't write back and just say, reread the instructions. He did give more of an answer to try to assist the jury. And I realize it's an abuse of discretion standard, but I think given the clear intent expressed by that jury question, that the answer yes would have been the appropriate response. I do have, so that pertains to the punitive damage award. I do have a broader issue in my brief that we've advanced concerning the testimony received from plaintiff's not accident reconstruction expert, but he was our scientific expert from Exponent, Dr. Russ Ogle, who we moved in limine, and we urged Judge Reagan during trial not to allow Dr. Ogle to express opinions about custom and practice in the grain handling industry.
Ogle was an expert on fire safety. Are grain bin fires so sui generis that only an expert on grain bin fires could offer an expert opinion here?
On the fire, that drives right to the heart of this issue. To the fire, I think that Ogle is qualified, and we so designated him as an expert on behalf of Westside as to the cause and origin of the fire. However, he went too far in our position when he started talking about what accepted practices for handling the hot bin were, given that he's got no experience in handling grain, never worked in the salvage industry, and basically it conceded at page 94 of volume 6. He said, customs and practices in grain handling industry are outside my bailiwick. And so the opinions that he expressed against Westside, specifically that Westside should have made sure that more pellets or made sure the fire was out before they started removing pellets. He described Westside's methods that they used as dangerous.
Well, why are grain bin fires so different in kind from other fires as to disqualify him? I mean, what?
Again, I think that Ogle can certainly talk about the cause and origin of the fire, and we endorsed him for that. But when you go beyond that testimony and say, now I'm going to criticize the salvage company for their methods used in trying to clean pellets out of the bin, that, by his own admission, was not his area of expertise.
I may be really off the wall, but I thought that the argument about, you know, asking Ogle about inserting an air lance
right,
into the core, if anything, his answer was helpful to you.
No, it was helpful, but the issue that we take issue with on this appeal is he did render opinions that Westside's methods in handling the grain and trying to remove pellets from the bin were dangerous, and they should have done it in a different manner. Now, that has nothing to do with the cause and origin of the fire. He's rendering opinions without any expertise or foundation about how a salvage company should handle removing grain from a bin, in a hot bin. So I appreciate your time, Your Honor. If you don't have any other further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you.
Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today on behalf of Conagra. I reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start by picking up on the colloquy with Mr. Schultz about Flitch's decision to send the two men, Jens and Becker, back into the bin. In the 20 minutes that he was up here at the podium, he didn't and couldn't deny that the testimony is undisputed that they had safely evacuated the bin, those two, Jens and Becker, before the explosion, and would not have been injured at all but for Flitch's decision to send them back into the burning bin for their tools. Putting aside all other issues in this case for the moment, and I'm happy to get to all of them in a moment, that decision alone shows that the awards against the judgments against Conagra on behalf of those two plaintiffs cannot stand as a matter of law, because Flitch's conduct broke any conceivable causal chain between anything that Conagra did or didn't do and those plaintiffs' injuries. There's no way that Flitch's conduct, which was the district court's only basis for awarding punitive damages against Westside, could be deemed to be reasonably foreseeable to Conagra, which is the basis that the other side has proposed for coming up with, responding to our proximate cause argument. So again, I think the colloquy we just had about punitive damages in Westside only underscores the infirmity of the liability determinations against Conagra with respect to those two people. Again, I think it's telling that plaintiff's own expert, Ogle, conceded that they had safely evacuated the bin and would not have been injured. So we respectfully submit that on that proximate causation ground alone, judgment should have been entered on behalf of Conagra as a matter of law. Turning to Judge Easterbrook's question about when it was foreseeable that this thing could have exploded, the testimony is very clear here, Your Honor, and I point you to pages 535 to 537 of the appendix. That's volume 2 of our appendix. And this is a passage in which Flitch has kind of discussed the events of that day of the explosion, April 27th. When they come back from lunch, he testifies that he sees smoke coming out of the bin. And at that point, he concedes. He says, "Now you know there's a fire in the bin, right?" Answer, "Yes." This is at 536. Get to 537. "Would you agree with me, Mr. Flitch, that you allowed at a minimum 2 hours to pass in which you knew there was a fire in the bin and you didn't call the fire department?" "True." "And we can agree that for those 2 hours, you didn't tell Freet," that's Conagra's guy, "that there was a fire in the bin?" "True." "Wasn't that valuable time for you to protect yourself and the crew members to get them out there?" "Yes." "Shouldn't you have ordered an evacuation?"
"What does that have to do with my question?"
Well, I thought your question, Your Honor, is isn't it understood that
I thought I made this clear. I'm not asking what was understood or what was in anybody's heads. I'm talking about data, about objective risks. If you take a sample of, say, 1,000 bins in which you can see smoke, what's the average lapse of time between seeing the smoke and an adverse consequence like an open fire or an explosion? What's the variance? What's the standard deviation? Those are objective questions. It doesn't have anything to do with what's in anybody's head.
Correct, Your Honor. And I don't know that people were asked specifically about time. I think what everyone testified, Your Honor, is that when there is a fire in the bin, there is a risk of explosion at that point.
Risk. How big is the risk?
The risk is substantial enough that you should not send somebody back into a burning bin.
You're now talking off the top of your head. I'm asking about the contents of the record. What does the record show about how big that risk is? Right? Forget about time for a second. Of the bins in which one sees smoke, how many ever explode? Does the record show that?
I cannot answer that off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm sorry. We can provide you with a citation.
Everybody's
for that.
Talking off the top of his head.
Well, but
I
one...
really want to know what the evidence shows.
Okay, Your Honor. There were experts, Ogle and...
I'm sure there were experts, and I'm really trying to find out what they were saying.
Your Honor, and I will try to have that by the time I get up for rebuttal, Your Honor. One thing, though, again, is that Flitch testified that he knew that he should not, whatever an expert would say, that he knew that he should not send somebody back into a burning bin in the first place. And he did that. He should once they came back from lunch and they knew that smoke was coming out of the bin, at that point, he should not have sent them back to the bin. He recognizes that. Again, I would really ask you to look at page 537 of the appendix, where he is asked this point blank, and he concedes that he knew there was a fire in the bin at that point, and he should not have sent them back into the bin at that point, and he did. So, again, I think our proximate causation argument, which is a very clean argument, is one that the material facts are undisputed. We also have a more fundamental argument, Your Honors, which goes to the issue of duty. And again, remember here what's going on. Conagra knows it has a problem in its bin. It recognizes that it has a hazardous condition in the bin. That's why Conagra, when it starts smelling smoke on March 12th, the next day they call Westside, which advertises itself as a company that can deal with grain elevator removal when there is a fire or a potential for a fire, and has done more work with these kind of grain bins that present these kind of fire hazards than any other company in the country. They call them out the next day, and they're there. And they, you know, there is a delay before Westside ultimately starts work. But
they
nobody's
say you're
injured
looking
by
for
that.
Somebody else.
I'm sorry?
Looking for a cheaper.
Correct, Your Honor. But again, and West Conagra would have been in trouble if the bin had exploded in that interim period when they were looking and a bystander had been injured. But
well,
that's not the kind of case we're talking about. I'm sorry, Judge Roman.
No, I'm sorry. The written contract that was sent to Westside defines the scope of the work as, quote, remove all pellets from bin 15 using vacuum bin whip and entry as needed. Does that undercut your argument that Westside was hired to remediate a potential fire hazard?
Absolutely not.
I mean, where's the mention of this being a hot bin, a fire hazard?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because it's undisputed that what Westside does, they remove pellets. Removing the pellets from the bin and remediating the fire hazard are two sides of the exact same coin. The way you remediate the fire hazard is to get the pellets out of there and to clean the bin. So removing the pellets from the bin is the objective description of the work. That's like saying if you have a contract with somebody to remove lead paint from your basement, it could say remove paint. It doesn't necessarily go on to say in order to abate the risk. I would appoint you, Your Honor, to page 867, app 867. That was Westside's president, Schwerz, who was their 30B6 witness at trial and was speaking for the company, was asked why they went out to Conagra. And he acknowledged that they went out there to, quote, fix a hot bin. It was understood all along that the removing the pellets was part of the same mission of remediating the hot bin, and there's no inconsistency between that and the written contract.
But even if Westside was hired, at least in part, to remediate a hot bin, couldn't the jury have found, based on the testimony of Westside's witnesses, that Conagra was less than forthcoming about the history and the potential
Absolutely
the
not,
potential
Your Honor.
Hazard?
Let me make one kind of broader point. This issue was not presented to the jury. It is not as if this was teed up by the district court as, you know, I hear what you're saying about this duty issue, but I think there are material facts here about concealment that require resolution by a jury. The district court rejected our motion for summary judgment on duty on the ground that there was a deliberate encounter exception to the contractor's rule in Illinois. He didn't dispute that there was a contractor's rule in Illinois. He just said, well, there's a deliberate encounter exception. So we explained in our brief that was a legal error because there is no deliberate encounter exception to the contractor's rule or the fireman's rule. Those people are actually going specifically to do the job. If you had that exception, you wouldn't have the rule. So, again, it wasn't as if the jury was being asked to look at this question. But then going specifically to your question, Your Honor, about concealment, this is a very important point because the other side kind of says, well, there's some material issues about concealment. Let me say this, Your Honor. If you look at their brief, what are the things they said are concealed? And they focus primarily on two things. First, they say we soaked the bin with water the weekend before they got there, and we never told them that. And that, in a sense, lulled them into a false sense of security because it tamped down the smoke and the danger. Their only cite for that, Your Honor, is SUP App 103. I would really urge you to look at SUPAP 103, because what it says on that page, Plaintiff Schmidt was asked, gee, did Conagra do anything the weekend before you got out there? His answer is, yes, they soaked it with water. And I know that because Conagra told us that when we got there. So what they are citing for the proposition that Conagra withheld that information is actually testimony that Conagra gave them that information. The other thing they cite for this alleged concealment theory, Your Honor, is assertions that we didn't share temperature readings with them when they got out to the bin, because we'd been monitoring the bin for the whole several weeks since Sumner had been out there in March. And but there is the testimony is undisputed that when they get to a hot bin site, they do all the temperature readings themselves. They never asked us for temperature readings and we didn't disclose them. They don't need our temperature readings because the testimony is undisputed. In fact, this is testimony by their own expert, Russell Ogle. This is our reply app 13, that conditions in a hot bin, in the temperature, change constantly. So he uses the words, these earlier readings don't matter once Westside gets there. So the idea that this is a concealment case is, with all respect, a post hoc fabrication of them to try to make it seem as if Conagra brings in this company to salvage the bin and then secretly tries to undermine the very efforts that it just hired somebody to try to do.
Does the record show anything about how many hot bins Conagra has and how often, I don't mean hot bins, I mean bins, and how often a hot bin occurs where something has to be done?
There's some discussion of that in Freed's testimony, Your Honor. This is around pages 480 to 481, 482 of the appendix, when Conagra, it says, has 1,700 or so bins, but Conagra needs an expert salvage company like Westside for expertise in dealing with hot bins. That's your testimony.
It doesn't say how often that occurs.
It doesn't say specifically, but, it is not unheard of.
Not uncommon, sort of?
I don't know if it's to say it's not uncommon, but certainly it is a known danger when you have all these grains or pellets in bins that you can have a combustible situation. But again, Conagra is not the expert in how to deal with hot bin. If it had been, it would have dealt with this internally. But the day they found out that they had smell of smoke coming out of here on March 12th, that day they called Westside to come in. And again, I think it's very important.
And that's their normal procedure in the event of a hot bin.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, there's no testimony that Conagra, has the hot bin expertise. And to the contrary, the testimony is that Westside, and to this very day, if you go on their website, it still says, customers, grain elevators, experts in elevator fires and emergency removal. We are experts when there is a fire or a potential for a fire.
I probably should know the answer to this question, but I don't. Had ConAgra ever dealt with Westside before?
It had. There was testimony that they called Westside because they had dealt with them. The Miller, Scott Miller, I think was his name, the guy at corporate headquarters in Omaha, the day this came up, he knew of Westside because they had dealt with them at some point in the past. And I don't remember if that was a hot bin situation or not, but there is testimony that they did have some previous relationship with Westside. And again, I think the testimony is undisputed, and I again refer you to the Sumner testimony at 185, that Westside, app 185, Westside has as much experience as anybody in the country in dealing with hot bins. So again, I don't think there is any suggestion here that we somehow went to somebody who didn't know how to deal with this situation. We went to the people who are the foremost experts in the country at dealing with this kind of situation. And frankly, I think as the testimony I just read from Flitch indicates, they botched the job. They got to a situation where they took out 80 to 85% of the pellets. They're down by the hot core of the bin. Smoke is coming out. And what do? At that point, Flitch concedes he should have ordered an evacuation and called the fire department. He sends the guys back in there. And that's the problem. We are sitting here now stuck with $170 million of liability for punitive and compensatory damages when we hired somebody to deal with this problem.
By the way, what would a fire department do with this situation? Is there any evidence in the record about that?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. Chief Lockhead, the fire chief, was asked that question point blank. And he said he wouldn't know what to do with the hot bin situation because the fire department is not in the business of remediating hot bins. He would have called Westside. And so,
in other words, the answer is we don't know what
well,
the fire
certainly,
department would have done, or the fire department would have just walked away and
well,
said,
I'm
you've
sorry,
got a problem.
I may be misunderstood. If he had been called instead of Westside at the very beginning.
No, I'm not asking about the
beginning. So you were asking on that day.
You see, the fire department is called.
Yes.
As it was called.
Yes.
And it sees smoke.
Yes.
Does it do anything other than say, please evacuate this building?
I think that's a very good question. We don't know the answer.
I want to know what's in the record.
The answer is there was no time for that because...
The answer is not there is no time for that. You're now testifying. What does the record show about the answer to my question? If it shows nothing, then it shows nothing.
Right. I'd say the record shows nothing on that.
Okay.
Okay. The final point I would just like to make sure to address is they also say in their brief that not only did we allegedly hire a company only for cleaning. This is how they attempt to get around the contractor's rule in three basic ways. They say, well, their mission was just to clean the bin. Hey, their name is Westside Salvage. They say, oh, you concealed this soaking and these temperature readings. Okay. And their third one is to say, well, you exercised control over this. We did not exercise control over this. What they point to for that, their main evidence, is testimony of their expert witness, Ogle, who says that this is an app 336 to 337. They cite this repeatedly. It's also at their SUP app 42 to 43, but it's the same pages. He just testified that he looked at Flitch's testimony and interpreted Flitch's testimony to be saying that Conagra didn't want them to cut a hole in the side of the bin as opposed to removing it from the tunnel. But there is no evidence, there's not one shred of evidence in this record that Westside ever went to Conagra and said, we believe it is good for safety reasons to go through a hole in the side, and Conagra said no. And if there were such evidence, they would have cited that instead of citing expert testimony, which is not fact testimony. That's just testimony of their expert witness of having read a deposition that doesn't even say that. So they ultimately fall back on saying, well, Conagra had ultimate control over the site. Well, if that's true, as a landowner, we did have ultimate control. But that's not the legal test for assuming operational control over the decisions of an independent contractor who you hire. So again, I mean, just taking a step back, this case is really as much about common sense as common law. Even if Conagra was negligent in letting a dangerous condition develop, at most it was responsible for creating a condition by which an injury is made possible. But again, it's Westside's act that caused the injury, that proximately caused the injury, and were not reasonably foreseeable that Westside, which is an expert in this, would have behaved in such a remarkable way. And in any event, Conagra, under the contractor's rule, owed no duty to protect Westside's employees and subcontractors from the very hazard they were brought in to remediate. This is not a situation where they were brought in to remediate a hazard and they slipped on a puddle by the door of the facility. They were injured here by the foreseeable and inherent hazards of a hot bin. So this is at the heartland of the contractor's rule, we'd submit.
This may be begging the question, but is it anything in the record that shows, I guess I'll call it a history of any explosions with Conagra's bins?
Your Honor, no, not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. If I'm cutting into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Mr. Orlando? Mr. Shapiro?
May it please the Court, I'm Andrew Shapiro for the plaintiffs. I'll start by trying to answer the question of the day from Chief Judge Easterbrook. It was October, I'm sorry. Judge Easterbrook, now that we're in October. As I understand the question, it was...
Always chief in my heart.
Your Honor, as I understand the question, it was what data is there in the record, what evidence is there in the record about the probability of an explosion once you see smoke? And there is no evidence in the record about the probability of an explosion after you see smoke, but I think there's a reason for that, and it might make sense to ask a slightly different question. There's a difference between a fire hazard and an explosion hazard, and that becomes important in this case. The data that one would want, but there's only limited data in the record, and I'll tell you about it in a moment, is the relationship between carbon monoxide in the bin and explosive risk. I think the data, whatever anecdotal testimony there is, and I'm not sure one could actually do a scientific study of this, is that bins smoke sometimes. They smoke on and off. To my knowledge, no one has ever done a study of the link between smoke and an eventual explosion. This bin was smoking on and off starting in March at various times. The smoke just became much more heavy on April 27th. It became black and billowing, and people thought that was a bad sign. The record does.
Was that after a substantial decrease in the amount of pellets?
Yes. The salvage company.
Something about 80% had already been taken out.
The salvage company had removed 80% of the pellets and gotten down to the core.
So more oxygen is reaching the areas at the bottom.
That's correct. Now, the record does show that on March 12th or March 13th, I could be wrong, when a carbon monoxide reading was taken, the level was not yet explosive. It was under 500 parts per, I'm not sure what the denominator is, but let's assume per million.
What does carbon monoxide have to do with the risk of explosion?
Dr. Ogle testified.
More carbon monoxide means that there's more combustion going on. But the risk of explosion, unless I'm completely off of my understanding, the risk of explosion has to do with the amount of dust in the air.
Not quite, Your Honor. The testimony from Dr. Ogle, and I believe from the plaintiff's expert Schroeder also, is that while dust is one of the things that explodes, and he sometimes describes it as smoke becoming explosive as well. Carbon monoxide, which we normally think of as something that's not explosive, you worry about it in your car or your basement, carbon monoxide itself can ignite if it gets well above, I think the level had been 500 parts per million on March 12th, which is not explosive. Apparently during the time period up till April 27th, the levels increased, but we don't know what the levels were because ConAgra and Westside didn't test the carbon monoxide levels. And that's in keeping with the pattern and I would say the culture of doing exactly the opposite of what one would want to do if you were behaving reasonably and taking safety into account throughout this time period. ConAgra tries, and I think if anyone is making a post hoc effort here, it's ConAgra, the defendants, to squeeze itself within something it calls the contractor rule, to say that there's no duty. We're in the good position here of basically having one case, so all of us can read it. The court can read it. We've read it. Your Honor's clerks can read it. It's the Keating case. Keating does not, by any stretch of the imagination, hold that when a company calls in, when an individual or a landowner calls in an expert, that it is absolved from liability if that person who is called in is harmed by the condition that was created by the landowner. All of the argument here is taking place against background tort principles.
I'm a little lost. Your own brief concedes at pages 23 to 24 that there is a rule of law that the landowner is not liable when a specialist contractor is called in. Your only qualification of that rule is that the contractor has to know the risk. And then the question is whether it isn't clear on this record that Westside understood that this was a hot bin and therefore knew the risks.
I don't think that's the case.
You don't have to go beyond your own brief for the statement of the rule.
So, Your Honor, I'm just looking at that page of our brief. That's not correct. So, what we say in page 23 and 24 of our brief is that landowners need not protect contractors from dangers the contractor was hired to repair when the contractor knows of the danger it faces and, in other words, has assumed the risk of the harm. We're distinguishing ConAgra's case law there, which
so
all stands
are,
for...
Are you saying that when Westside finally began to work in April, it was misled into believing that the potential fire hazard had dissipated?
Yes, and here's
how. Is
that
what you're saying?
Yes, here's how. That it was not as serious as they should have been told. So, first of all, the temperature readings were concealed, and there's a reason for that.
How are the temperature readings concealed? Did Westside ever ask for them?
There's no evidence that Westside asked.
Well,
but
you can't conceal something unless somebody asks.
Well, ConAgra's...
Hire a specialist, and the specialist will then tell you, you hope, what it needs to know. So if the specialist says, we need to know the temperature readings, and you lie or don't give them the temperature readings, then it makes sense to say they've been concealed. But if the specialist doesn't want to know the temperature readings, what's...
Well, but here's what the record shows, that after March 12th and March 13th, when Mr. Sumner from Westside told ConAgra that you need to deal with this, and ConAgra started to shop around hoping to find a cheaper contractor to deal with it, that Mr. Freet from ConAgra deliberately lied to Westside, telling them that the temperatures had abated and it started to go down. So they didn't have to ask. Freet, when Sumner called him and said, can we come out and start on this job, did not want to tell them that he was shopping around for someone cheaper.
Yeah, but so, bottom line, it seems that, I mean, Westside seemingly does have a professed expertise in dealing with hot pins. It had been on the job for a week at the time of the explosion. It had emptied the majority of the pellets from the bin, it would seem. So why at that point in time did ConAgra have a legal duty to the plaintiffs?
There are other things that ConAgra did not tell Westside. It did not, and I also invite the court to look at the pages of the appendix that Mr. Landau pointed to, did not inform Westside that it had doused the pellets the day before. I contend that this is important in whether Westside ever would have come out and taken the job. It told them that temperature readings had gone down when, in fact, they had not. It did not convey the observations of smoke during the period from March to April. It did not convey the concerns expressed by workers. And Mr. Sumner...
Well, let's take... It did not tell them that the temperature had not gone down.
It falsely told them the temperature had fallen.
All right. They falsely told them that the temperature had gone down. Are you saying that Westside, who are the experts in all of this, wouldn't have taken the temperature?
Mr. Sumner said that he might not have taken the job if he had known of the high temperature reading and that ConAgra would not agree to have the fire department available. That is in the appendix at page... I'll get the page.
But is it true that the fire chief testified that he wouldn't have known what to do?
No.
So why would it matter?
No. What the fire chief would have done, and there's ample evidence in the record of this, the fire department would have shut down and evacuated the site. And under ConAgra's own policies, that should have been done as early as March. In March, if ConAgra had listened to its own employees, and there are many...
I must say, the idea that when a fire department comes, all it does is evacuate the site and then people stand around waiting for an explosion is quite impossible. People have to go in and remediate.
Well, at least as an initial matter, the site would have been evacuated. They testified that the railroad line which goes by would have been
shut
down.
Until you do what? Until you call somebody like Westside?
Well,
a specialist.
No. Westside... I have to disagree, is while they have experience with hot bins, Westside is a salvage company that salvages grain so that it can be sold under all kinds of circumstances.
So who other than Westside would have been called? In your view, the fire department is called, it shuts the site because it doesn't know what to do, and it turns to a specialist, or it says ConAgra should turn to a specialist. Who is that specialist?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, the fire department was in a position to fully douse the pellets, but that would have meant they couldn't be sold.
I thought, at least from Mr. Landau, that the fire chief testified that he hadn't a clue what to do. Is that incorrect?
I don't believe that is accurate, Your Honor, but Mr. Landau...
What do you think the fire chief testified to? We're obviously going to have to go and read the testimony if the two of you can't agree on what he said.
Your Honor, I do not know whether the fire chief testified as to what he specifically would have done beyond shut down the site, although grain bin fires also are allowed sometimes to burn themselves out. And this is where the difference between a fire and an explosion, I think, become important. When
you said grain, with hot bins or grain fires are allowed to burn themselves out, that's one of the common remedies or at least reactions?
Yes, but then you can't sell it. of course. You can burn them out.
Well,
you can
seal. It destroys
seal
the grain, you're saying.
It destroys the grain. There was about $15,000 worth of pellets that ConAgra wanted to sell. So rather than shutting down the site, sealing off the bin, or dousing it entirely back in March before it was explosive, according to all of the expert testimony, they shopped around. They let it get worse. Then they called in a salvage company to try and save the grain so
and,
that they could
that,
save
see,
it.
This, that's why I want to know sort of the big picture is what's the if there is a common practice with a grain fire or pellet fire, if you confine it to that, what is the standard practice of dealing with it?
Here's what you can do. You can either seal the entire bin. That was difficult in this case because there were vents at the top so that it cuts off all air. You certainly stop running trucks in and out. You stop running ventilators because that blows air on them. You can douse the entire bin with either water or you can fill it with an inert gas. All of those things ruin the value of the pellets. All of those things would have been wise things to do. But
well, dousing it with water ruins it?
If you soak it completely, they become, the testimony was, they become mushy and hard or impossible to sell. They turn
to ConAgra apparently did douse it.
Well, what ConAgra did was make the situation more dangerous by dousing just the top so that you had smoldering underneath. And in fact, Mr. Sumner and Mr. Flitch testified that, rather it was Mr. Flitch testified that when he arrived on April 20th, he was surprised by the condition of the bin because it looked so clear and clean. It did not seem to be what he expected to see. But what he, of course, didn't know is that the water had been poured over the pellets and therefore the hazard was submerged and not
immediately.
Somebody
just said that they did tell him, but maybe that's not in the record. No.
I looked at that section of the testimony, and Mr. Schmidt himself says that he poured water on the was pouring water from essentially a garden hose into the bin at times. And it's unclear, I think, when he was told that water had been poured on it by ConAgra. There's no testimony or no evidence that Mr. Flitch was ever told that the bin had been doused. But I think all of this goes to an argument about assumption of risk, which I think if the court looks further in our brief, need not be determinative in this case. So there's the background principle of tort law that says a landowner is liable to an invitee if he comes onto his property. There's a firefighter's exception in Illinois, and I think the cases that we cite in our brief all make clear that it is an exception for firefighters and public safety people only.
I want to ask you a very simplistic question, and it's this. Why didn't Mr. Flitch's order to Jensen Becker to go back into that bin cut off ConAgra's liability to them? Why would that sort of an order be foreseeable to ConAgra?
It is entirely foreseeable that workers would be in and around the bin until the site was shut down by the fire department. In fact, the colloquy...
Yes, but that's not what happened here. They were in, they were out.
And that's why Westside was held partially liable by the jury. There need not be a single proximate cause. There can be multiple proximate causes. And in that regard, the jury instruction that was given here without objection, which accurately characterizes Illinois law, the pattern instruction read as follows. A proximate cause is one that in the natural or ordinary course of events produced the plaintiff's injury. It need not be the only cause, nor the last or nearest cause. It is sufficient if it combines with another cause resulting in the injury. That absolutely describes what ConAgra did, and the Illinois cases are clear that that's a decision for the jury. So ConAgra agreed that this jury instruction, it did not object, this pattern instruction was appropriate. This pattern instruction said it need not be the only cause, nor the last, or the nearest. It is sufficient if it combines with another cause resulting in the injury. That went to the jury, which under Illinois law is entitled to decide whether something was proximate cause, and the jury was well within its rights to find that ConAgra was liable and Westside was liable. It apportioned liability fairly rationally. It said 44%, 45%, and 35% respectively for the plaintiffs to Westside, 54, 51, 65 to ConAgra. This is not a case like the ambulance case where someone calls the city and says, send an ambulance to take me to the hospital, and the city, of course, can't anticipate that the driver of the car is going to run a red light and a drunk going 70 miles an hour will come through the other way and hit the car. It's quite foreseeable if you're ConAgra and you don't clean a bin for 17 years, You don't follow your own policies to call the fire department on March 12th when there's already smoldering and smoking. You don't listen to your own employees who say, call the fire department. You require these men to work in the tunnel. It's quite foreseeable that they will be in and around the bin until it's shut down by the fire department, and so it's a proximate cause.
And nothing broke the chain of causation.
No. Well, the test for an intervening efficient cause, and by the way, the burden for that under Illinois law is on the defendant, is one that's not remotely satisfied here. I mean, again, the proximate cause is one that can combine with another cause resulting in the injury. And along those lines, there's some relevant testimony from ConAgra's team leader, Mr. Belcher. Actually, it was an exhibit, an email from March 31st. We have this in the appendix. Who wrote, the bin heated up yesterday, giving off very burnt smell. Remember, this is March. Worse than ever. Need to get this taken care of. West side looking better. Job would have been done by now. So if ConAgra had done what its own team leader said, call West Side in, get the thing fixed now, instead of letting it become more and more dangerous over 6 weeks, no one would have been injured. No one would have been around the bin. No one would have been in the tunnel. If they had not required these workers to work in the tunnel, and I guess this comes back to Judge Easterbrook's comment earlier about a question about what the fire department would have done. There was testimony in the record, I think this was from Dr. Ogle, that one safe way to remove pellets in a situation like this is to cut a big hole in the side of the bin, but that ruins the bin and can ruin the pellets as well. If ConAgra had followed its own safety procedures or the safety procedures of the national organization on which one of its Omaha employees sits, none of this would have happened. So plainly, it's approximate cause.
Is that hindsight, or is that somebody? Did somebody recommend cutting a hole in the side, and he said no?
What the testimony was from Mr. Sumner, I believe, is that when he was told to work in the tunnel, he said, hey, I'm here and I'm hired by these guys, and if they tell me to work in the tunnel, I'm going to do that. So there wasn't testimony that anybody specifically said to ConAgra, cut a hole in the side, but there was testimony that ConAgra's own people knew.
He thought there was high risk, though, would he? I mean, I don't understand the tunnel, right? But that's beside the point.
So,
I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of, in hindsight, we did all kinds of things. You know, explosion. Nobody anticipated an explosion, and otherwise they would have gotten away from it. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what people understood and did and used their expertise in doing as the conditions evolved over a week.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people anticipated an explosion. Employee after employee at ConAgra went to their superiors and said, this is a very dangerous situation. It could explode or it could catch on fire. We need to do something about it. And they were told that that was not their decision to make. They called Omaha, and Omaha slowed things down. And there's a reason for that. ConAgra wanted to save the pellets, and it wanted to save money. And if the law were as ConAgra's counsel suggests it should be, which is that you can absolve yourself by waiting and waiting and waiting as the situation gets worse and worse and worse until the very last minute, and then you call in someone who hires some laborers.
Wait, when's the last minute? I can understand when the day of the act.
Well, the last minute, according to ConAgra's own policy, should have been March 13th. Once there is fire or smoldering that can't be put out without a fire extinguisher, and that, the testimony was in May, under their own policies, you're supposed to call in the fire department. But if you call in the fire department, the site can be shut down indefinitely, and so there would have been a tremendous cost. So what ConAgra chose to do was to take a risk and to say, let's gamble, and I hope we're right, and I hope we're right, and things are getting worse, and things are getting worse, and things are getting worse. Okay, we'd better call in somebody. And now, under their version of the law, they can just wash their hands of it. But they can't, and there's another reason under Illinois law, because Illinois has a very robust deliberate encounter doctrine. The deliberate encounter doctrine says that even if, Judge Rovner, they knew when they came in, Westside was aware of the risk, even if it was open and obvious, if they encountered this foreseeably as part of their employment, and this is what Judge Reagan himself found as an alternative basis for the ruling, then that does not absolve ConAgra of the duty. And the key cases on that are Lefevre and Morrissey. So even if this court concludes that Westside was aware of the risks, that does not absolve ConAgra, which created the risk by waiting 17 years to clean the bin by ignoring the signs of danger. That does not absolve ConAgra of liability.
Is there testimony in the record as to how often a bin should be cleaned?
I believe they're supposed to be cleaned yearly, but I can't remember which witness said that. We can provide materials to the court if necessary. I believe it's supposed to be yearly. And there's a reason for that, because the same way with, for example, a sugar bowl, if there's moisture, the sugar becomes hard and caked and hard to get out. The longer you leave pellets in there, they turn to almost concrete. They're harder to remove. They become compacted, and the danger of this self-ignition becomes greater and greater. It's almost like a compost heap as well. Now, as a policy matter, ConAgra suggests that here's our page. As a policy matter, ConAgra suggests that it would be a bad policy to discourage people from calling in experts to deal with dangerous situations. But the law should and does impose liability on a landowner who creates a dangerous situation, who fails to act promptly to address it, who ignores employees' requests to call the fire department, who makes unreasonable decisions that exacerbate the hazard in order to avoid shutting down the business, who conceals facts about the hazard from invitees, and who imposes conditions on the invitees that exacerbate the hazard. That I think, is the stronger policy argument here. It would be a bad policy, if it were even the role of this court to make policy for Illinois, to have a policy that says, if you call in an expert, anything you've done up till that point is washed away. The piece of the transcript I was handed suggests that Sumner, the leader from West Side of the team, when he was asked by ConAgra to provide a cost estimate, proposed putting a hole in the side of the bin. But that never happened. So I think from that the jury was entitled to infer.
Who suggested that?
Sumner, Sumner from West Side, when he gave his cost estimate to ConAgra about how much it would cost to salvage the pellets, provided a cost estimate that said, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to cut a hole in the bin. They were later told to work in the tunnel, so I think the jury could have inferred from that West Side's preference or suggestion was to cut a hole in the side of the bin. There were punitive damages awarded in this case, and the punitive damage award was entirely proper. ConAgra, I'm sure, will have something to say about that in its rebuttal. The jury was instructed that willful and wanton conduct is a course of action which shows indifference to or conscious disregard for the safety of others. And ConAgra.
One of the reasons that I was asking my question about the known risks is to figure out how much disregard for the safety of others there was. Let me come back to the simple version of my question, which is, what does the record show about the probability that a smoking bin will ever explode?
There is no empirical data about
Isn't that absolutely essential? If the probability is very high, and the defendants then were sending people near this very high risk, you would reach one conclusion. If, on the other hand, it turns out that 1% of smoking bins explode, and then only after a long time, sending people near that risk doesn't look nearly so willful and wanton. And if we don't know the answer to that, how can we figure out whether the record supports a conclusion by the jury that, et cetera?
I think it's entirely legitimate for this court, and it was legitimate for the jury, to look to the testimony of the individuals charged with safety at ConAgra in that regard, because that testimony was unanimous. While it may not have been able to be reduced to percentages, the unanimous testimony was, once you have a bin that is smoldering, there is a substantial
danger.
There is
a risk. How big is the risk? Right? If you ask the U.S. Marshals Service whether there is a risk in allowing you and the audience into this building, the answer is yes. The Marshals Service would really like to have courthouses where no one was allowed in, and then there would be no risk. But we accept that risk because the estimate is that it is small. It's not zero. There have been violent acts in U.S. courthouses, so the risk is not zero, but it's small. Figuring out what to do with risks depends on quantifying the risk, not on saying, is there a risk? Right? The fact that you all went through metal detectors on the first floor
demonstrates the belief of the Marshal Service that there is a risk. But we need to know how big, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, what this record shows about how big is the risk.
Let's assume that the Marshals have a handbook that says if you see something that is shaped like an L, you should investigate because that could be a gun. And if you see someone who is wearing a tinfoil hat saying to himself, please stop telling me to go and kill judges, please stop telling me to go and kill judges, you should pull him aside and interview him. We may not know
actually,
what percent...
The guy wearing the tinfoil hat is probably the most
pro se
harmless person in the building. Right, but you're not answering my question.
Well,
right?
I'm doing the best I can with the evidence in the record.
You're saying people who are charged with dealing with risks will have lists of things to look at because they think that's where the risk is. But my question is not what do people look at to deal with risks, but how big are these risks? How imminent are these risks? That's what seems to me a critical question in this case. And if, as you're implying, the record is silent about the size or imminence of the risk, then I think you have a problem.
We know that it is big enough so that the internal regulations of a company like Conagra say shut the site down.
That's why I use my example. The risk of harm in a courthouse is big enough that we have metal detectors and a large staff of armed guards down on the first floor and circulating through the courthouse. But that doesn't mean it's particularly large.
If there were a safety procedure that said when the person with the tinfoil hat walks through the metal detectors, the courthouse should be evacuated, I think one could infer that a decision had been made by people who've thought about this, that that is a substantial risk. And I don't think that Illinois law requires there to be a quantification of the risk, and that I certainly think a jury here could have concluded that Conagra created a dangerous situation, it failed to act promptly to address it, it essentially had a pattern of doing the exact opposite of what its own safety policies mandated it should do. It ignored...
Is that pattern nationwide or wherever with Conagra?
Well, there was evidence about other problems they had had in Puerto Rico, and there was evidence that the folks in Omaha were concerned about the costs of shutting down multiple bins. That's, I think, the extent of it in the record. There is evidence that they ignored repeated requests to call the fire department by their employees, and you end up with two people burned alive, essentially, who suffered horrible injuries. It is not, I think, by any means inappropriate for there to be a substantial award of punitive damages here.
Award of compensatory.
There was, and the reason for that is because these two people survived. So if they had been killed, their compensatory awards would have been far less. They were burned alive and have survived. Mr. Jentz was so badly burned that they couldn't give him an IV. They couldn't find a vein. They had to drill into his bone to give him pain medication. These people are permanently disfigured and maimed. Mr. Schmidt spent 80 days on a ventilator before they could take him off of it. Jentz was so badly burned they couldn't tell his race. It's not a surprise that the compensatories are high here, and one of the reasons that there's a reasonably sized punitive award is because there were large compensatories here. But compensatories are meant to provide general and specific deterrence as well as to punish, and we know of no award where there was a ratio of 1-to-1 in which a court struck it down, has been struck down by a court as constitutionally excessive. I don't think you will find many other cases where someone was hurt as badly as Mr. Jentz, at least here, and actually went to trial. But Conagra made the decision to try this case, and the jury came back with a reasonable decision. The fact is, companies should not ignore safety rules. They're there for a reason. And while there is nothing wrong with a company making economic decisions, perhaps shopping around for another contractor, and there's nothing wrong with a company trying to salvage what it can from grain bins, the jury quite reasonably could have concluded here that Conagra crossed the line in putting profits over the safety of people.
Anything further, Mr. Orlando?
Yes, Your Honor. Very briefly, just to go with a couple of record sites, if I might. First, as I think you started out with the questioning in this round, the concealment theory that they have is critical to their response to our duty argument. let's go to their concealment theory about the soaking. This is sub-F 103, and again, I invite you to look at this, but let me just actually read the question. Question to their plaintiff, Schmidt. Did you learn whether or not any Conagra employees had done anything in that bin in that weekend before you guys got out there to that facility? Answer, yes. They had said that they had dumped a few thousand gallons of water on it that weekend before, prior to us showing up out there. And this is in the context, you'll see, of the conversations of what they were being told the day they got out there. So that pretty much, I think, kills their concealment on the dumping theory. Then with respect to whether or not they had all the information, I would like to just quickly read App 494. This is Flitch's testimony. Okay, on the 20th, this is the day Westside began the job. You had all the information you needed to do the job safely. Answer, correct. You had an opportunity to inspect the bin. Yes. Okay. Then he was asked, this is App 513 to 14, you had adequate time to inspect every inch of bin 515 for dangers. Agreed. And was asked, any concerns you could have had about any delay in the bin having been responded to? Non-existent, right? I didn't see any problem. No. So Westside's own foreman, who they sent to the site, is conceding that there was no problem with the delay in Westside having gotten there. He actually says, any delay that took place in fixing the situation in the bin, any problem with that? And his answer is true. There was no problem with that. You didn't see any dangers caused by that. True. That's App 514. With respect to the fire chief, there were some questions about that. He was asked point blank, have you ever been called out just to consult on what we call a hot bin? Answer, no, sir. Question, would that be a situation where you would need to consult with somebody that has knowledge of the conditions of hot bins? Answer, yes. So the fire department concedes that if we had done what the plaintiffs now say we should have done, they would have had to call the west sides of the world. Judge Rovner, I think you asked about causation. Well, the answer that he gave is basically, well, a jury could have found that this was reasonably foreseeable. I mean, this was the conduct of sending somebody back into a burning building. This was the only ground the district court identified to uphold the punitive damages award. How on earth that can be reasonably foreseeable as a matter of law is beyond me. And we cite cases on page 36 of our brief where this...
often go into burning buildings, although rarely to retrieve tools.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, but again, I think that that decision is not the kind that would be reasonably foreseeable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, taken under advisement.